This is a Federal News Network podcast.
Welcome to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP, the federal leader in retirement planning seminars sponsored by WEPA. Join NITP for an hour of plain talk on planning your future. You've got questions, they've got answers.
Good morning and welcome to the March 2nd, 2020 For Your Benefit radio show. We're here with my mentor, Tom O'Rourke, attorney at law, knower of all things tax. And Tom invited me to go on the air. It's been a while ago, Bob. Yeah, I still think they had cranks on the telephones. But anyway, and I took all my books and I studied them and I brought them down and we did a show like this. And it was, and from then on, I thank you every time I walk in front of a group.
Well, you're most certainly welcome.
All righty, and Tom still knows it all. So we're going to talk about taxes, and we're going to talk about the Secure Act, the recent change in the law, and the like. But let's take a look at it's tax season. It's March 2nd. We got April 15th looking at us. Of course, we can extend it and the like. But IRS had a press release. You were telling me before we went on air. Something about people that don't file tax returns?
Right.
Are there such people?
Well, there certainly are. According to a study for 2018, there were approximately 10.6 million people who were required to file tax returns but didn't file them. So that number obviously alarms IRS. Their job is to make sure we all comply with the tax code. So they last week issued an information release announcing a program to contact people who were obligated to file but didn't file. And essentially what they said they're going to do is they're going to send out revenue officers, collection officers, to visit you in person. These visits will be unannounced. They aren't going to send you a letter because by the time you get to that point, you've gotten numerous letters from IRS and ignored them. So what they're going to do is they're going to start sending out new collection officers to contact you to find out why you haven't filed.
Well, that would mean they hired people.
Yeah, apparently they have. Apparently they've hired a large number and recently completed training for new collection officers. And they say it's going to be sort of low key, but my reaction from getting calls from clients who've been visited by an IRS official is never low key. For the person, when the revenue officer comes out and shows them their official credentials, they're very official looking, scares the heck out of them. And I think what the IRS wants to do, they don't want to put anybody in jail, but they do want people who are supposed to file and pay their taxes. And at least initially, that's going to be the only action they take.
Yeah, I don't deal in your world because you're the attorney that has to defend some of these folks. I don't think the bulk of your practice is that. But, you know, I tell people if they do get a call or they didn't file and then they get a notice you need to file within 30 days. And I don't blame them. They should be nervous. But I said all they want is the tax return. Now, if you are self-employed and you didn't pay any taxes in throughout the year, you're going to have a headache. But it isn't like they'll work with you and discount it, but they'll put you on some type of payment plan. Not a pleasant one, but, you know, if you didn't file your return.
Right, right. And as you said, what they're really looking for is to make just get you to satisfy your obligation. And they've tried to make it easier in recent years. But before I talk about that, I want to mention that in their information released, they know there are a lot of scam artists, and I'm sure you've had clients who've gotten these calls. I've gotten these calls telling me that there's a special agent on his way to arrest me because I haven't paid taxes unless I send him a certain amount of money by way of a gift card. That's a clear scam, and IRS probably knows about that better than anybody because they get a lot of calls from people who want to check out and see if it's legit. It is not legit. But what they're proposing to do is send out people, and these individuals will only come to see you after you've already gotten a number of written notices from the IRS saying, Bob, you haven't filed, and after sending out three or four notices, they'll send a person to come see you, and that person will always have official-looking government credentials. Be aware that the people that call you on the phone are probably scam artists. The people that come to visit you in person and show you proper credentials in all likelihood are legitimate, and they want to work with you to make sure you satisfy your liability.
I had a client years ago, a widow, and received one of these letters. And believe it or not, the guy's name supposedly was Max Gold.
Okay.
So I called Max up and I said, hi, work with Mrs. Da-da-da-da. And I just want to make sure I have everything straight. I understand you're coming Tuesday at 4 o'clock, and you know, I'll have everything there. But I'm going to invite some friends. I'm going to have the IRS there. I'm going to have the state police. And I'm going to have an attorney. What time should you want to really be there? I won't tell you what he told me to do. But I was surprised he talked to me that long. Anyway.
Well, usually the first time I got one of those calls, I kind of played along with him. And then he said something and can't be repeated on the radio and eventually hung up on me. They are con artists.
Yeah.
But if you will know, if mm-hmm. you have a liability and you haven't filed your tax return, you know that the person coming to see you has a legitimate reason for visiting. One of the things I want to point out is IRS has really made it fairly easy for you to work out a payment agreement. You can go online to irs.gov, and if you owe them $50,000 or less, you can propose your own installment agreement. And as long as it meets certain basic criteria, they'll accept it. All they're interested in is having you file your return and pay your taxes. They aren't going to send you to jail unless you refuse to cooperate, but it's something that they're serious about getting people to comply with the law.
Okay, so we've dealt with those folks, and our listeners probably know people that we talked about, but our listeners are generally a federal audience, and they have things with regards to this law that was passed. What do they call it, the Secure Act?
Oh, the Secure Act has been getting a lot of publicity because it has a big impact on a lot of people. Anybody who has a tax-deferred pension plan like the TSP or a 401k is affected by the Secure Act. And the Secure Act did a number of things. Number one, it moved back the age at which you've got to start taking minimum distributions. As anybody who's reached age 70 knows, under prior law, when you reached age 70 and a half, you had to start pulling money out of a tax-deferred plan and paying taxes on it. The Secure Act passed that, moved that date back a little bit. Now you don't have to start taking required minimum distributions until you're 72. So you got another year and a half to allow your money to stay in the tax-deferred account and grow tax-deferred. The second thing it did is something that a lot of people aren't real happy with. They have limited the period after the death of the account owner to leave the funds grow tax-deferred to a maximum of 10 years. A very common strategy, and I'm sure you've had guests on this radio show who talked about a stretch IRA. When one person dies, if they leave their tax-deferred accounts to another younger individual, the younger individual could withdraw that money over their life expectancy. So if you left it to a very young person, a grandchild, you could allow that money to stay in the account tax-deferred for 50, 60, 70 years. The Secure Act terminated your ability to do that. Now, when an account owner dies, whoever inherits that has got to pull the money out within 10 years. Now, there are a couple exceptions to that, but for the most part, you're no longer going to be able to take advantage of the stretch provisions of tax deferral.
Okay, so if we were looking at a 10-year term, so to speak, do they have to take it out evenly throughout that, or could they wait till the last day of the 10th year?
As I understand it, they can wait till the last day. At the end of 10 years, the money must all be out of the account.
Yeah.
But you maybe from a tax perspective, from a tax planning perspective, it would make sense to take it out ratably, but you're not obligated to do that. And there are several pretty important exceptions to that. For example, if you leave the money to your spouse, he or she can continue to take it out over their life expectancy. If you have a minor child, they don't have to pull it all out until they reach the age of majority, which I think in most states is 18, which probably scares a lot of people who have 18-year-olds. Mm-hmm. If the beneficiary is somebody who's disabled, they can extend the withdrawal period. But for most individuals, the ability to defer for a very long term, the ability to pull money out is no longer.
I wonder, correct me if I'm wrong, there was a provision maybe long ago where if they changed a provision in the law that generated a tax savings and it had to be offset by something that would otherwise be taxable.
Right.
So I guess there was some balance, the good with the bad. And there seemed to be so much good with this Secure Act, but there were a couple in there where they took some back, this being one of them.
Oh, yeah. And obviously the people that is going to affect the most are people that have high balances in their tax-deferred accounts. And I've been dealing with TSP participants ever since the TSP has been in existence. And what many of them are finding, they've got a lot of money in there. And it's enough money that if they took advantage of stretch provisions, they could pretty much guarantee the financial security of the next generation and the generation after that. But what they're going to need to do is they're going to need to revisit their plans, because in the last 20 years, I've structured a lot of estate plans where a federal employee who had a substantial balance in the TSP would totally skip their children's generation, because hopefully the children were well-established, didn't really need the money, and they used the money to provide for grandchildren, specifically education. That's not going to be possible now, so you may need to revisit your estate plan and look and see what you've done and try to figure out another possible option to accomplish your goals.
All right. Do you ever – some children manage money better than others. So when we're building a plan, is there a way – somehow that if there was an emergency, they could get to the money, but if they didn't, they couldn't take out more than X dollars a year?
Well, what you've described is a very common goal for many people. If you have two children, they're going to be dramatically different, and one of them may be a good money manager, the other one may not. So the common way to always provide for somebody who doesn't do a good job of providing for themselves is to leave assets in a trust for their benefit. And by doing that, you always give the trustee the right to invade trust principle to provide for extraordinary needs, a health problem, even a short-term amount to help meet a mortgage payment for somebody who got laid off. Or you simply give them the trustee the ability to say, no, I'm not going to pay the gambling debt you ran up at a casino, or I'm not going to pay your credit card bill until you learn how to spend a little more prudently. But you're vesting a lot of discretion in the person who you name as trustee.
So there's no exception for buying a new car?
A lot of times there is. I've had people ask me to write in, the trustee shall spend money to buy my child a new luxury automobile every 3 years. Or you can say, you can buy an automobile, but it doesn't have to be a Porsche. It can be a used Toyota.
Well, I bet with that we've earned some days. So anyway, it's Andrew tells us it's break time. So why don't we listen? Don't turn off and listen to what the good folks at WEPA, the sponsor of the show, can do for the listeners.
You have life insurance to protect the people you love. As a civilian federal employee, you have two choices designed specifically for you. WEPA and Fegley. The big difference? Price. Chances are WEPA premiums will cost you less. In fact, the average WEPA member saves $375 per year on premiums. Prioritize your peace of mind with a life insurance policy designed for feds by feds. If you're a civilian federal employee interested in comparing WEPA to Fegley, visit WAEPA.org today. WEPA is a proud sponsor of 4-Year Benefit, presented by NITP, Mondays 10:05 to 11 a.m. on Federal News Network, 1500 a.m. WEPA has been ensuring the future of federal workers for more than 75 years. See why over 46,000 feds have already switched to WEPA at WAEPA.org.
Welcome back to 4-Year Benefit. We're here this morning talking with Tom O'Rourke. He's an attorney at law with Miles & Stockbridge, a tax expert par excellence. How long you been doing this, Tom?
A long time, Bob.
Okay.
40-plus years.
I
was speaking at a seminar about a week ago, and I happened to mention that I was in the Army, and I mentioned when I got out of the Army, and I realized it's going to be 50 years this June 23rd.
Really?
When I got out of the Army, it took me a while to start practicing law. I had to go to law school first, but I've been doing it for a while.
Well, when I got out of the Army, I was a reservist, so let's not think that I was in there for 8 years. It was very hard finding a job. It was the 70s. The job market was terrible. And a friend of mine said, would you like to do some tax work? And I said, I would like to, but I don't know anything about it. And he said, it doesn't make any difference. We'll teach you. And that was 1970.
Okay.
And once it caught on, I think you and I probably share the same like for what we do. It's not that we're trying to take advantage of but if the tax law has the provision to grant our client a provision that somebody might not have otherwise thought, that's what we do.
That's right. There's a famous case where a justice is quoted as saying everybody wants to minimize their taxes, and taking advantage of that is fine. And that's really what you and I do. We help them minimize taxes by taking advantage of legitimate provisions in the Internal Revenue Code.
Okay, so if we're back talking about the Internal Revenue Service Code, we talked about this, I won't say quickly, but should we revisit estate plans as a result of the SECURE Act? You hit that kind of hard, but I think it's people are so overwhelmed with that change that they might have missed it.
Oh, yeah. There were a whole lot of things that were changed by the SECURE Act. The two that have gotten the most publicity is the moving back the date to take required minimum distributions, which is wonderful. It's not mandatory. If you want to retire when you're 55 and you want to start pulling money out of your TSP, you can do that. The new act doesn't say you can't access your money, but if you're fortunate enough not to need the money to support your everyday lifestyle, it makes a lot of sense to allow it to sit in the TSP and continue to grow tax deferred as long as possible, which now is age 72. So that's good. The other part of the SECURE Act has gotten a lot of publicity is the requirement to withdraw all your money within 10 years after the death of the account owner. And that's the thing that could have the big impact on estate plans. And if you're an individual who has got, in your mind, a substantial amount of money, and substantial can vary from people to people. I've had some people tell me, well, I don't have much in the TSP. I only have $1.5 million. And I've had other people tell me, oh, I got a bundle in the TSP. I got over $100,000 here. So substantial is you make the judgment as to what it is. But if you've taken that into account in developing your estate plan, it would be a good idea to revisit your estate plan and see how the SECURE Act affects your long-term plan.
When we look at that, you know, we deal with people mid-career, pre-retirement and whatnot, and the federal retiree with their base annuity is probably better than what most people have outside the federal sector. And then we have Social Security, if it's more so a first person, and we have the thrift. So in the drawdown, in other words, when again, primarily with FERS, one source isn't going to meet the income needs to support the individual and or the family. What do you look at first? Now, this is, I don't know that anybody's ever nailed this, and I don't know that they can. Which one do they go to? Certainly, they're going to take the annuity. I won't say certainly, but generally, you're going to take that first. But again, that might not pay everything we need for our expenses. Then we get into the issue, and this is not a financial planning question. We get into the issue, do we take Social Security first? Do we let it grow and take the money out of the thrift and or the IRAs to make our ends meet? What do you do there, Tom?
Take it out of the IRA versus
the— Social Security. If we wait to take Social Security later, we get more.
Right.
We get more of a benefit, but we're taking money out of an investment that's in theory growing. So.
Well, I have an answer, and I have a very definitive answer.
Okay.
But it may not be consistent with what a lot of financial advisors would tell people. And I always mention this in any class that I teach. The very first tax course I ever took was when I was in law school. And the teacher said, if you can avoid a current tax liability by taking advantage of the provision in the tax code, do it, because that provision may not be there next year when you want to take advantage of it, because the tax code changes all the time. So my bias tends to be in favor of deferring the income tax hit I would realize by taking money out of the TSP. So I'd try to tell them to do both, because I think it's a good idea to try to maximize your total Social Security benefit. But if you can't do it and you really need that Social Security to live on, my personal preference would probably be to take the money out of Social Security and allow the money in the TSP continue to grow.
Okay, good.
But again, that's purely a personal opinion. That's not one of those answers that's black or white. And I know there are a lot of people that disagree with me.
And it should also be clear to everyone, we're not financial planners. We're, in a sense, financial advisors on tax benefits.
Right. And one thing I will never forget, I think it was one of the financial planners who teaches for NITP made the comment that when you're doing financial planning, any financial planner, any advisor is going to give you their advice, but it's your money. And you always make decisions that you're comfortable with for your own reasons. Listen to your advisors, but if you don't agree with them, remember, it's your money, and you do what you think is in your best interest.
Well put. Yeah. And in my life, I'm a tax guy.
Sure.
I'm doing tax returns and tax planning and the like, and you say, well, this makes sense tax-wise, but it might not make sense economic-wise, but I'm not a financial planner. So if you got a crossroads here, which one do you take? And they said, well, we came to you for that advice. And I go, I can give you the tax side of it, but the economic side of it is sometimes, I would say, more important.
Yeah, it's always more important.
Yeah, it's got to last them for the rest of their life.
Yeah,
other
that's
than
right.
that, it's easy.
That's right.
All righty. The change in the law, they changed itemized deductions, not so much in what you can deduct. There was some change there, but now they have this thing called a standard deduction that they always had. It was a flat amount, and you always got your choice. Were you able to itemize with a mortgage, with charities, et cetera, or you could claim this flat amount? But the flat amount now isn't just a flat amount. It encompasses other things. So what's inside of that basket of deductions that's now called the standard?
Well, the standard deduction for a married couple this year is $24,800. And for a single individual, it's $12,800. Essentially what that means is if when you add up all your itemized deductions, you come up with a number that's less than the standard deduction, it makes more sense for you to take the standard deduction. And on many individual returns that I look at, the following are the basic deductions they can claim. They can claim their interest on their home mortgage, which they can still do. There are some limits on that. If your mortgage is more than $750,000, you can only deduct interest on the first $750,000. That probably doesn't affect too many federal employees. There's also a limit on your ability to deduct all your interest on a home equity loan. You used to be able to deduct any interest on a home equity loan. Now you can only deduct it to the extent you used the proceeds of the loan to maintain or improve your home. So you can still deduct interest. Many people deduct state and local income taxes, and many people deduct charitable contributions. But as I'm sure you know, the ability to deduct all your state and local income taxes has been dramatically curtailed. Now, an individual cannot claim a deduction for state and local taxes of more than $10,000.
And that includes real estate taxes,
that includes
doesn't it?
Real estate taxes.
Wow.
And if you live in the D.C. metropolitan area and you're a two-income couple, your income taxes alone probably exceed $10,000. So your real estate tax deduction is now worthless to you as far as reducing your taxes. What many people are finding that when they add up the interest they pay plus $10,000 in taxes plus whatever they donate to charity, they come up with a number that's less than the standard deduction. And one sort of thing that I read in the Wall Street Journal right after the 2017 Tax Act was passed, apparently the stock of H&R Block took a big hit after the 2017 Tax Act was passed. And the explanation for that was people are no longer going to need to itemize their deductions. So they're probably going to be able to prepare their own tax return without seeking professional assistance. And the sole reason was with the 2017 tax law that became effective in 2018, it no longer made sense for them to itemize deductions.
Interesting you say that. I've had more than a few nice clients, but the return wasn't overly complex, and they go, I want you to do this one more year, but I want to see what I'm missing, and would it be easy enough for the individual to then feel comfortable about doing it themselves. I'm sure they're going to use some software product to do the return. Please don't try to do that manually, but there are some that like it, very few. Mm-hmm. And I go, I understand. It's just the way that it is. Or if you are able to time things, it's pretty hard. But if you were able to time itemized deductions into 1 year, and then you itemize, and then if you use that to itemize, then it's going to be a lot lower. But so what? Because you claim the standard.
Yeah. Yeah. So what I would encourage people to do is look and see which is going to make the most sense for you. And if you go to a professional preparer, they're going to tell you that. If you use TurboTax, TurboTax is going to tell you, you should use the standard deduction. Makes more sense. So it's easy to figure out. And I think many people will find that now it does make sense for them to use the standard deduction.
When you work with your clients, what do you find their biggest disappointment with the change in the law? Is it not necessarily itemized deductions, but it might be a special tax treatment that they got for selling XYZ small company? I'm not talking about people that have big businesses who are trying to keep this within the federal frame.
Well, I don't run into this a lot, but people that I do advise, first of all, when somebody comes to me and asks help in preparing their tax return, I say, you're in the wrong place. Give Bob Lyons a call, because I do not prepare tax returns. The only tax return I prepare is my own, and I consider that to be drudgery. But what most people that I've talked to complain most about is their inability to deduct all their state and local income taxes. For many people, they have state and local income tax liability of more than $30,000, and they know they got to pay it. The state government's still looking for their money, but they can only deduct $10,000. And I get the typical complaint, it's not fair. And I usually get by that pretty quickly.
I do. I get the same thing, and I can empathize with them. I can understand it, but I go, at the end of the day, if your income is somewhat the same after the change in this law versus what it was before under the old, see if there's a major difference in the tax. Now, I was maybe I'm Pollyanna with this, but I thought that most people, almost everybody, would have received a lower total tax under this new provision. I found that that's not always true. Now, the delta might not be dramatic, but, you know, I'll ask people in the class, you know, do you know anybody that was hit the wrong, I don't want to say raise your hand if it impacted you. And I'm surprised at the number of people. I'm not saying it's half the class, but it might be in a 30 or 40 person class, it might be 10 people.
What many people make a mistake in doing when the new law was passed, the amount of withholding was decreased from their salary. And they got a smaller refund, so they're figuring.
Or they didn't get a refund
after getting a refund for 30 years. And they were very, they said, my taxes went way up. And if you look at the bottom line amount of taxes that they paid, they actually were relatively comparable. But at the end of the line, when it came to the day of reckoning and filing the return, they had to write a check rather than getting a refund. And that was very painful.
This was my theory on why that happened. The new law passes the last few days of December. Do you really think the withholding charts were ready for withholding on computer-generated company or government? No. Then after that, did they do it and kind of made sure that that person had more in their paycheck? And then at the end of the year, a number of them were short. Now, I'm not a conspiracy type, but that's the best way I could explain it. And then I said, okay, once you're over this, culture shock, then you know there's kind of a new minimum that you have to pay in and shouldn't vary dramatically because our income doesn't dramatically change. But boy, they were mad at that first year.
Oh, they were really mad when they had to write a check.
And then what I also do, I said it's a little early in the year, we're March, but January and February, I'd say wait till May or so and project out what you figure your taxes are going to be. Many people are using the computer-aided software products to do it.
Sure.
So I said, save the old one, put in what you figure the income is going to be. You can do that pretty easily with your W-2 and project it out. And you're withholding. At least now you got 8 or 9 months to fix it.
Yeah.
But if you're doing it in December, there's not much time
left.
No,
if you're doing it in December and you should have been taking out an extra $300 a month,
yeah.
That means at the end of the year you're going to come up with a tax bill of around $3,000, sure. Which is going to hurt.
Yeah,
so, it's, but also the IRS on their website has a very helpful tool in allowing people to estimate their tax liability. It's really easy to use. Just have last year's tax return available. You know what your salary is, and you can come up with a very close estimate of what your ultimate liability will be.
Okay, if we're looking at saving taxes, which I would assume most people would. In our wheelhouse, is there a way to increase? I mean, you can increase the contributions to the TSP, but of course, that means you're going to have less bring home.
Well, one of the things I tell people all the time is that the easiest tax decision anybody has to make is to put as much money into the TSP as you can afford and as the law allows. And how much can that be? Well, if you're under 50, it's $19,500 this year. If you're over 50, it's $26,000 this year. If you can afford to do that, it makes sense to do it.
So, okay. Andrew says it's time to do it and take a break.
Yeah.
So why don't we take a break? We'll come back in and talk about more good things tax-wise.
Who do you trust when making your most important decisions? National Institute of Transition Planning has been the trusted source for federal retirement planning, serving new, mid-career, and pre-retirement federal employees for more than 30 years. NITP's subject matter experts bring more than 800 years of collective expertise on federal benefits, financial transition, and estate planning. Visit NITPinc.com. That's NITPinc.com to sign up for their free monthly newsletter and information about free webinars.
Does planning for retirement seem like a daunting task? Is retirement years away? It will arrive sooner than you think. Prepare now to stay on track. Join the thousands of federal employees and retirees who have already attended National Institute of Transition Planning's free monthly webinars to learn more about retirement and financial planning. NITP is the national leader and trusted source for federal retirement information. Visit NITPinc.com to sign up for NITP's free monthly newsletter and webinar.
Welcome back to For Your Benefit, March 2nd, 2020. We're here with Tom O'Rourke, attorney at law, tax attorney at law, Miles in Stockbridge. You know, Tom, I mess this up almost every show. How does somebody contact you?
Well, the best way is to send me an email. And my email address is T O'Rourke, O-R-O-U-R-K-E, at Miles, M-I-L-E-S, Stockbridge, S-T-O-C-K-B-R-I-D-G-E, .com.
Could you do that again? I'm slow.
Okay. It's T. O'Rourke, my first initial, my last name, at Miles Stockbridge. And there are two S's right together in the middle of that, .com.
Okay. So, took me a while, and I had to write it down.
Well, it takes me a while when I write it down. I always mess it up.
So. Okay, so we at the break, we had paused, and we were into the TSB. We need to button it up a little bit more, I think, with regards to taxes and the benefits and the Roth TSB. That's a whole show versus right. Traditional TSB.
Well, one of the more common questions I get in seminars, and I think this is true for your tax speakers, your financial speakers, which makes more sense for me, the Roth or the traditional TSP? And the answer I always give, and I get accused of giving a lawyer-like answer, was it depends. Because there are some people for whom the Roth can make a lot of sense. There are many people for whom the Roth TSP does not make sense. And the only way to figure it out is to look at your own individual circumstances. Look at what your income is now, what rate of tax you're paying now, and then you look at what your tax rate's going to be when you retire. And that's all information that is available to people. Most people, many people that you and I meet, are in a planning for retirement seminar, so they already have pretty accurate projections as to what their annuity is going to be and what their Social Security is going to be, and they know how much they have in the TSP. So it's something you can figure out. If you don't think you're capable of doing it, then maybe you should sit down with a financial advisor or a CPA to try to get some help in doing that.
I found the rub of the people that probably should change didn't want to change from a deductible TSP to a Roth TSP because they didn't get the tax deduction.
Absolutely. I just before I came down here this morning— a lady had called me, and she wanted to put money in Roth TSP because she thought it was a really good idea, and she wanted to max out. She wanted to put in the full $26,000, and I said, that's fine, but do you realize that's going to increase your tax liability? I think in her case, it was about $9,500. She said, oh, my God, I didn't know it was going to cost me that much. So I think that deterred her from putting money in the Roth TSP.
I've got the same thing, and they're very unhappy at that point. I said, but why don't you do this? It's kind of like going to the shore and jumping in the water or not, depending on how the temperature is. I said, ease into it. $26,000 or whatever the number is a lot of money to totally turn the switch. Take 10%, 20% of that number, give it a try, and see if it it probably should not hamper your lifestyle, and then do it again the next year.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. For those individuals who really want to have some money in a Roth account, and there are a lot of good reasons for doing that, perhaps the best reason is that when you retire from federal service, with the changes in the TSP withdrawal options, you can now transfer that money directly into a Roth IRA. And if you don't need that money to support your lifestyle, you can let it grow forever. You aren't required to take minimum distributions from any amount in a Roth IRA.
That would include the individual, if sure. They happen to be a spouse. But after they're gone, when they pass, then that same tax-free benefit would extend to the person that inherits it.
Right. That's right. And an important point to emphasize, that's only available if money's in a Roth IRA. If you leave money in a Roth TSP, the rules are different. You do have to take minimum distributions now starting at age 72.
I knew you were going to pick on me with that. Because if you just listen, you'd say, I didn't know you could do that. I thought you had to take something out. Right. Yeah. Out of the Roth TSP.
Right.
Not the Roth IRA.
Right.
Okay. All right. And this would, our listeners may have had a private industry stint prior to joining the federal government, or a spouse or a friend. So, you know, the rules of the TSP are maybe a little bit different than what they might be in a 401k or this school teachers, whatever, their 457, whatever right. The numbers are. Everything's got a number.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
But everything has a number for another reason. Some of them are not the same as the other one with regards to the tax savings.
That's correct.
Okay. The other, when we talk in class, I'm a little surprised at this, but it's only because I live in the world. They're not aware that you can move IRA money, taxable IRA money or non-taxable IRA, as it may, case may be, into the TSP. And I explain, it's kind of like a street. You can go up the street or down the street, but in this case, if you put money in, then it's easy to take it out. Or you can, if you can move TSP money to an IRA, you ought to be able to move IRA money to the TSP. Now, it's not any IRA money, but it would be the fully taxable component thereof.
Right. And you're right. I run into a lot of people who have had careers in the private sector or in a not-for-profit sector. And they really like the TSP, and there's a lot to like about the TSP. It's a wonderful tax-deferred savings plan. And if you're approaching age 72 and you don't want to have to start taking money out of your outside IRAs, you can take that money that has never been subject to tax, roll it into the TSP, and by doing that, you can decrease the amount of your minimum distributions. And fairly regularly, I bump into people who've continued to work for the federal government beyond age 72. They enjoy their work. They find it challenging. Their health permits them to work. And they want to defer taking the minimum distributions. And it can make a lot of sense to take that money from the private sector IRA or 403B or 457 plan and roll it into the TSP.
You mentioned something just a minute ago, the term rollover versus transfer. I hate to be a pain in the neck with this. No, you didn't say anything wrong.
Yeah.
But I in class, I said, well, what are we going to do with this money now when we move out of the TSP? Are we going to transfer it or are we going to roll it over? And, you know, everybody says, I'm going to roll it over. And then I got this little graph. Well, if you pick the rollover, the money gets in there, but it's diverted. And then 20% is withheld for taxes. And then it gets in there. And I said, it's a simple thing, but we're so seasoned to say rollover.
Right.
And I'm sure I bored the people to tears with that, but let's move forward.
Yeah. To make sure the money goes directly from one plan to another.
Got it.
To avoid the 20% withholding. Yeah. And the thrift board is not taking that money out just to be mean. They're required to do it. They don't have an option.
Yeah. Yeah. And I hear that. Why do I have to do this? And I said, because you checked the wrong box. And there's a way to get around it too, but that's for an advanced show. So how about if we want to, people say, well, I don't want to do all Roth TSP. Can I just put a little in? Sure. You can change your withholding and divert it to see how you like that, then put some more in. But to totally turn the switch, it's pretty hard to do.
It is, because in my example, that's a big, that $9,000 tax hit is a big bite to take all at one time.
There was in the class when I talk about this, now I'm not a financial planner, but invariably you have to talk about the tax angle to it, and then the finance is going to be more important. And people are surprised that they can still put money into an IRA even if they've maxed out the money going into the thrift.
Absolutely. That is one of the most common misconceptions I deal with when people will tell me, I can't put money into an IRA because I'm maxing out in the TSP. And my answer is, so what? They're two different financial planning tools. One, the TSP only applies if you're a federal government employee. IRA is available to anybody who's got earned income. And if you can afford to max out on the TSP and still put money into an IRA, it can make a lot of sense to do it. And one of the things I talk about all the time is trying to get money into a Roth IRA. And some people aren't eligible because they make too much money. And if they make too much money, I know something that you and I have talked about many times is there's a backdoor way to get into it. And that's a little more convoluted to explain than we have time to discuss here. But it always provokes a 15 or 20-minute discussion in a seminar. And my guess is if you put money in an IRA with any investment management company, you know, Fidelity, Vanguard, they are probably going to have a pretty good idea of what the backdoor IRA is. I'm always
happy to see the people that raise their hand. I said, do you understand how this works, or have you ever heard of it before? And I would say most classes, it's more than half say, I'd like to hear it. I've heard of it, but I don't understand it. And then if you do it with a diagram, it's still a little rough to understand with the back door.
Yeah.
But then the back door just doesn't sound right, does it? It sounds like it's swarmy.
Well, one, I was teaching a seminar somewhere, and on my bio page, I tell them where I went to school, and I went to Notre Dame and to Georgetown. And I was explaining the backdoor IRA, and one very sweet lady raised her hand, and she said, Tom, how could you do that? Didn't that Catholic education take hold? You're telling us to go in through the back door. That sounds fishy. And it may sound fishy, but it really isn't. Congress was well aware that many financial advisors, many tax advisors, were advising their clients to take advantage of the backdoor IRA at the time they were amending the tax code in 2017. And there was a proposal to eliminate the ability to take advantage of the backdoor IRA. And that proposal got rejected. And when the proposal got rejected by Congress, I think it gave people like you and I and any other tax advisor a much greater level of comfort in recommending their clients to take advantage of it.
Almost every class I go to, I'd say, this sounds kind of sleazy, backdoor Roth. And when it first came out, it came out after the ability to get money into a Roth the normal way, if you will. Mm-hmm. And I just remember, I said, this is not going to have legs. Let's do it while we can. It's just a horrible name to begin with. And I remember one president at the time remained nameless, and two State of the Union messages wanted to do away with it. And again, it's not illegal. It's not immoral. It's not even aggressive. It's just an opportunity. And Tammy Flanagan and I did a show a number of years ago, and it's on the website. And half of the show was the backdoor Roth, form by form, and it was 20-some minutes on each. And the other one was the voluntary contribution plan. Now, not everybody can do the voluntary contribution plan. I would say most people can. It would be somebody CSRS that doesn't owe a redeposit. Anyway, we don't want to go there. Sure. So listen to the show.
Yeah, it's a very good show. That's the one that I listened to learn what I did about the backdoor Roth.
Yeah. Okay. Can you – people will ask this, and I'm sure in class when you go over this, can I still put money into an IRA even though I've already maxed out the thrift? We touched on this, but, I mean, that needs to be kind of
clear. The answer is yes. Yeah, all you have to do to put money into any IRA is you've got to have earned income. If you have earned income, you definitely can put money into an IRA. Now – if you want to put money into a Roth IRA directly, if you want to go through the front door, your income has to be below a certain limit. And that limit this year, if you're married and you file a joint return, you've got to have adjusted gross income of less than $206,000. And the ability to put money in starts to phase out, I believe it's at $193,000. Mm-hmm. If you're single, the absolute upper limit I think is 139 this year, but I'm not positive about that. But if you have earned income, you can certainly put money into an IRA, whether it's traditional or Roth. And I mean, even if it's traditional, and even if you don't want to go through the back door and you put money into a traditional IRA, you aren't getting a deduction, but at least you're having money in a vehicle that is going to grow tax deferred. It's going to earn dividends, interest, and capital gains every year, which aren't taxable as long as it's in an IRA.
Okay, talking about taking money out of an IRA and the like, we're getting to kind of the last bullet point or two. What should you do if you know that you owe the IRS money but can't afford to fully pay the liability?
I'm going to start out by telling you what not to do. Don't file your tax return. If you don't have the money to pay your liability, file a tax return anyway. Go to the IRS website, and assuming you owe less than $50,000, you can propose your own installment agreement. You can tell the IRS, look, I know I owe you $10,000, but I'm proposing this installment agreement. And generally, if you pay that, if you propose a reasonable plan to pay that off, IRS will rubber stamp it and approve it. They'll say, fine. If you don't file, automatically you start incurring a late filing and late payment penalty. And after only 5 months, that can increase your liability by 25%. So if you owe $10,000 and you didn't file and you didn't request an extension, 5 months later, you're going to owe $12,500 instead of $10,000. So you got to file and then propose your own installment agreement, or you can always go into an IRS office or try to contact somebody on the telephone. But I think it's a lot easier to work out your own installment agreement.
Okay. Anything we haven't covered that you wanted to say? We have all of a minute or so left, 2 minutes.
Yeah, I, if we have a few minutes left, I really want to emphasize the importance of filing because, again, as I said, if you don't, your liability very quickly multiplies. And if you had a financial problem because you couldn't pay your taxes, this is only going to compound a problem. And it's so easy to deal with, and it's something you can do on your own. You don't need to hire me or Bob to do it for you. In fact, I would discourage you from hiring me because you don't want to pay me to sit on the telephone and wait for IRS to answer my call, because they sometimes you have a long wait time.
They have the worst music. It's like the Blue Danube Waltz, right. And they haven't changed in 40 years. Anyway, sorry.
So, but go online and work out your own plan. And also, we've got about six weeks to go until your tax return is due. You might want to take a look at it and eyeball where you are. And if you're going to owe some liability, you may want to think about taking out a short-term loan or figuring out some other way. Because if you owe somebody money, the IRS is not a good creditor to have because they've got a lot of tools available to them that no other creditor has.
Okay. Andrew's saying it's time to pack up your toolkit. Tom, one quick way to get to you before Andrew tells us quick.
Well, the best way, again, is by email. And the email is torourke@milesstockbridge.com.
Perfect way to end the show. Andrew, I think we're still done. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP and sponsored by WEPA. Please tune in next Monday at 10 a.m. for a topic solely devoted to you, the federal employee. This show can also be heard on demand at federalnewsradio.com. Search For Your Benefit. Thanks for listening.